The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. And that is spelled GSUGGS Insurance.com. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated July 3, 2023. Our 100th year appears as a thumbprint in the upper right-hand corner. As usual, the front border is lined with red with a small white inner border. Time in large block lettering, capitals, is in white, superimposed upon a green and beige background. Seated there is someone who is not identified. It looks like a young man with combed up dark hair, light blue or green eyes, looking directly at the camera. He's seated in a black chair. He's wearing black, but not what we'd think of as business attire. Black trousers, black t-shirt, black jacket, gray boots. He's neither laughing, nor smiling, nor frowning, nor glaring. He's just looking straight at the camera. It may be OpenAI CEO Sam Altman, because this issue does feature the 100 most influential companies, according to Time. Beginning now with the brief, Making the Case, by Brian Bennett. To take Donald Trump to trial, bringing charges over his handling of classified documents, is only the first challenge. There's a photograph here of a rather large bathroom. In the background is a marble enclosed shower with a shower curtain in front of it. There are windows, not quite ceiling high, but upper level windows off to one wall. On the other wall is a toilet, and there is also a marble countered sink. A crystal chandelier, which is quite large, is hanging from the ceiling, and the floor also appears to be brown marble, like the shower and sink. There's a white wastebasket there, a plastic-looking wastebasket with a plastic liner in it, but stacked in the corner at a 90-degree angle are several boxes, such as one would use for storing materials, a cardboard box with a lid. One says, one has written on it, Pride, as if it were a name brand. Most of them are generic looking. I think they're called bank boxes. Then there's another one that says MAC, I think, bedroom. Anyway, these are all stacked at a right angle in this bathroom. Not up to the ceiling, but, oh, I'm going to count maybe 25 to 30 of these boxes. Again, this is the brief opener, and I'm looking for more. Okay, only Brian Bennett is the reporter here. Bringing historic federal charges against Donald Trump was just the start. The challenge for Justice Department Special Counsel Jack Smith, as he prepares to argue in court that the former president illegally took national defense secrets to his Florida home and defied efforts to get them back, is to make the charges stick. The 37-count indictment, handed down by a Miami grand jury, June 8, uses photographs, text messages, and the words of Trump's own lawyer to allege he stored some of the United States' most closely held secrets, including information about its nuclear programs, defense vulnerabilities, and attack plans, in a Mar-a-Lago Club ballroom, a bathroom and shower, his bedroom and office, a storage room, and then allegedly obstructed federal officials seeking their return. The charges that Trump denied at his arraignment in a Miami courtroom 5 days later included not only willful retention of national defense information, but also conspiracy to obstruct justice, concealing documents from a federal investigation, and making false statements. However formidable his evidence, Smith, a taciturn career prosecutor with a medieval-looking beard, faces substantial obstacles. The case was assigned to a federal judge who's already been chided by an upper court for inappropriately favoring Trump. Nearly everyone in the country has an opinion about Donald Trump. Jurors will be selected from a state he won in 2016 and 2020, and it takes only one holdout to bring a mistrial. And Trump is using his indictment to stir up crowds and raise money for his presidential campaign. The Southern District of Florida is known for presiding over a rocket docket that moves cases quickly, but Trump has spent decades stalling legal challenges and could try to push a verdict out past Election Day. Regardless of how long the legal process takes, neither indictment nor conviction would bar him from being elected. With the integrity of the U.S. justice system and possibly the outcome of a presidential election hanging in the balance, a lengthy trial in a high-profile case is exactly what the Justice Department does not want. Smith has spent nearly his entire career prosecuting. After graduating from Harvard Law School, he worked for the Manhattan DA's office, then the U.S. Attorney in Brooklyn, and worked his way up through the Justice Department to lead the unit that brings cases against public officials accused of corruption. After a stint in the U.S. Attorney's office in Nashville, he tolerated only a year litigating for the Private Hospital Corporation of America before moving to The Hague, where he charged war criminals for the Kosovo Special Prosecutor's Office. That is where Attorney General Merrick Garland found Smith when he needed an independent special counsel to oversee not only the classified documents case, but also the DOJ investigation into whether Trump tried to reverse the 2020 election or encourage the January 6 storming of the Capitol. The number one challenge on Smith's mind, says Renato Mariotti, a former federal prosecutor, has to be that the case will be presided over by Eileen Cannon, a Trump appointee, whose intervention on his behalf after the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago was reversed by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals because it created an unprecedented exception for the former president. A district judge like Cannon has very significant power at trial, says Mariotti. For example, prosecutors would not be able to appeal if she decided to throw the case out after the jury was impaneled. Should Trump be convicted, she would determine his sentence. She can influence the terms of jury selection and their instructions, as well as the trial's date and how long it takes. So the independence of the judiciary is also being watched closely, as is the calendar. The GOP selects a presidential nominee in just over 18 months. Even a run-of-the-mill federal case often takes a year at trial. In a case involving national security documents, the process often takes even longer. Trump may try to make this a complicated, intricate, self-justifying, confusing case. Smith needs to keep it simple, says Norm Eisen, former special counsel to the House Judiciary Committee during Trump's first impeachment. This is about a president who jeopardized our national security by removing documents that were classified national defense information and extremely dangerous, and when he was caught, he covered it up. Then there is the court of public opinion, Trump's preferred battlefield. The candidate has already tried to define Smith as deranged, a thug, a Trump hater. That may influence his faithful, but it is unlikely to make a dent in the prosecutor, Eisen says. Jack Smith has tried war criminals who have committed mass atrocities, so I don't think he's going to be daunted by name-calling by Trump. Good question. Who was the last VP to run for president against his old boss? This is by Olivia B. Waxman. The 2024 presidential campaign field, which already features the first former U.S. president ever to be criminally indicted, is about to get even more unprecedented. June 5, Mike Pence filed paperwork to run for president, making him the first former vice president to run against the president under whom he served in over 80 years, and only the third ever to do so. We have not had anything like this before, says Joel Goldstein, an expert on the history of American vice presidents and law professor emeritus at St. Louis University. History can be a bit confusing on this point. In the election of 1800, a sitting vice president, Thomas Jefferson, challenged a sitting president, John Adams, for the top office, but each was the leader of an opposing party. The electoral system was completely different back then. The candidate with the most votes was elected president, and the candidate with the second most votes became vice president. The 12th Amendment got rid of that system in 1804. The closer parallel to the Trump-Pence situation is when President Franklin D. Roosevelt ran for a third term in 1940, and Vice President John Nance Garner challenged him for the Democratic nomination. 6 years into the job, Garner had come to represent a group of conservative Democrats who believed FDR's New Deal was federal overreach. Nancy Beck Young, professor of history at the University of Houston, who consulted on a PBS documentary about Garner, tells Time his main concerns were deficit spending and that the federal government was supporting auto workers striking against General Motors in Michigan. Garner also opposed FDR's effort to increase the number of justices on the Supreme Court. Time summed up the tensions in a March 20, 1939 cover story headlined Undeclared War. Party rebellion is no new thing in U.S. history. Rebellion by the substantial leaders of a party against their leader-in-chief is rarer. And the rebellion which John Nance Garner now leads is rarer still, in that it is, save in small things, almost intangible, less a rebellion than a resistance. It is nonetheless the biggest political struggle now going on in Washington. But as Young puts it, at the end of the day, Garner's challenge to FDR was not substantive. Come the 1940 Democratic National Convention, FDR received 946 delegate votes, and Garner received 61. The Nazis had invaded Poland in September 1939. World War II was ramping up, and FDR's two terms as commander-in-chief made him the clear front-runner. FDR was elected with Henry Wallace as his running mate, and Garner retired from public life. Pence was the governor of Indiana when Trump asked him to be his running mate in 2016. The public split between the two men happened near the end of Trump's term, amid his efforts to overturn Joe Biden's election victory. Citing false claims of voter fraud, Trump asked Pence not to perform his constitutional duty and certify the 2020 election results, January 6, 2021. Pence insisted he had no legal power to comply with Trump's request, and as a riot of Trump supporters broke out at the Capitol, some chanted, "Hang Mike Pence." Some analysts have called Pence's presidential bid a long shot. Goldstein says VEEPs who run for president are in a unique position. Most vice presidents may have problems running for president, he says. You inherit the baggage of your administration. You are perceived as being a follower, not a leader. But one of the advantages is that you tend to inherit the support of people in the administration and the supporters of the president. That may not be the case this time, given the state of relations between Trump and Pence. The contest is on new ground in other ways as well. When Garner mounted his challenge, FDR was running for a third term. The 22nd Amendment would limit a president to two terms, starting in 1951. Trump is still eligible. There's a small inset here with head photos of 3, 6, 9, 12, 15 people. Some are on a red background, and some are on a blue background. And this is the field so far. Who is officially running for president in 2024? As of press time. For updates, keep an eye on time.com. Okay, these are the people. They appear to be in alphabetical order. Atop the red circles, Doug Burgum, North Dakota governor, Chris Christie, former New Jersey governor, Ron DeSantis, Florida governor, Larry Elder, talk radio host, Nikki Haley, former South Carolina governor, Asa Hutchinson, former Arkansas governor, Mike Pence, former vice president, Vivek Ramaswamy, entrepreneur, Tim Scott, South Carolina senator, Francis Suarez, Miami mayor, Donald Trump, former president, Cornell West, activist and scholar, and finally the three in the blue circles, Joe Biden, incumbent president, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., lawyer, Marianne Williamson, author. Miracle in the Amazon. This is nearly a half-page color photo. There are two people kneeling. These are adults. Both are in some type of uniform. I'm unable to read the indicia on the sleeves and chest labels, but one of them, who is dressed in olive green, is also wearing a red cross on his left sleeve. Both are wearing blue latex-looking gloves, and one is handling some type of a bottle of fluid. There are cords visible in the foreground, and below the cords, there appears to be a person. We can see only the top of its head. It appears to be a small child. It has very thin little arms and fingers, and it's reaching those fingers upward as if to grasp that bottle of fluid. It also appears to be covered in foil. Perhaps it's one of those high-tech thermal blankets. Miracle in the Amazon. Four children. One is pictured above with the rescuers, were found alive June 9 after 40 days in the Colombian rainforest following a plane crash that killed their mother and the pilot. The military had dropped food in hopes they would find it, and their family in the Huitoto indigenous community said they ate flour, seeds, and fruit. They were taken to a hospital in Bogota to recuperate. And I guess these are the rescuers. The Bulletin by Charlie Campbell. China's college graduates and its economy have a problem. China faces twin economic crises, an aging population, and young people who are expected to support them but cannot find work. By 2035, around 400 million Chinese, or some 30% of the population, will be age 60 or older, and the ratio of workers to dependents grows ever more unfavorable, as an estimated 228 million members of China's own baby boom generation will retire over the decade. Last year, China had 2.26 working-age people supporting each senior. That is forecast to drop to 1.25 by 2042. The youth problem is that youth unemployment in China hit a record high in April, with 20.4% of 16 to 24-year-old job seekers unable to find work. Some 11.6 million students are set to graduate in June, entering a labor market that looks increasingly bleak. Youth unemployment is a more pressing issue than the aging population, says Kiju Jin, an associate professor of the London School of Economics. Service jobs? Raising retirement ages is one real, if controversial, option. But for new graduates, the most acute problem is that the available jobs are beneath them. China suffers from a skills mismatch. Factories have faced worker shortages, while graduates are bereft of opportunities commensurate with their proficiency. The Chinese government is pivoting toward vocational training and expanding the service sector, which accounts for less than half of jobs in China, compared with roughly 80% in Japan and the U.S. Graduates will have to lower their standards and work in sectors that they would not necessarily have aspired to, says Jane Gawley, an expert on Chinese economics at the Australian National University. The economic outlook is especially problematic because young people in China account for nearly 20% of consumption, according to a Goldman Sachs analysis, meaning youth joblessness disproportionately impacts growth targets and the nation's coffers. The grim economic outlook has already prompted local governments to slash social services, sparking rare public protests earlier this year. The milestones page includes several under the died category. First of all, Tory, T-O-R-I, Bowie, B-O-W-I-E, a tragic reminder of a maternal health crisis by Allison Felix, who is the most decorated U.S. track and field athlete of all time and co-founder and president of SAYSH, S-A-Y-S-H. My former U.S. track and field teammate, Tory Bowie, was a beautiful runner, effortless. At the Rio Olympics, I ran the second leg of the 4x100 relay. Tory was the anchor. When she got the baton, I remember thinking, it's over, she just accelerated. At the 2017 World Championships in London, Tory won the 100-meter title, earning the title of World's Fastest Woman. Tory was 32 when she was found dead May 2. An autopsy, the results of which became public June 13, cited possible complications, including seizures brought on by preeclampsia, a high blood pressure disorder that can occur during pregnancy. I developed preeclampsia during my pregnancy with my daughter. The doctor sent me to the hospital where I had an emergency C-section at 32 weeks. I was unsure if I was going to make it. Like so many black women, I was unaware of the risks I faced. About 5 days after I gave birth, I mentioned at Thanksgiving dinner that my feet were swollen. My cousin said she also had swollen feet. Not once did someone say that is one of the indications of preeclampsia. None of us knew. According to the CDC, in 2021, the maternal mortality rate for black women was 2.6 times the rate for white women. Serena Williams had near-death complications during her pregnancy. Beyonce developed preeclampsia. Three gold medalists from that 4x100 relay team in Rio, all black women, had serious complications during pregnancy. We are dealing with a black maternal health crisis. I hate that it takes Tori's tragic passing to get people to pay attention to it. But we need that wake-up call. I am hopeful that Tori, who stood on the podium at Rio, gold around her neck and sweetness in her soul, won't die in vain. And that was told to Sean Gregory. Died Cormac, C-O-R-M-A-C, McCarthy, M-C-C-A-R-T-H-Y, American Voice, by Annabelle Guterman. Cormac McCarthy, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of often grisly, hyper-masculine fiction, died June 13 at 89 in his Santa Fe, New Mexico home. One of the most acclaimed, if reclusive, American writers of the past 50 years, McCarthy's darkest fiction centered on outsiders attempting to survive in violent worlds. McCarthy wrote a dozen novels since 1965. The 1981 MacArthur Fellow, who was hailed by the Foundation as the author of distinctively American fiction in the Southern Gothic and epic Western traditions, also wrote screenplays, short stories, and plays. Additional persons listed in the died category include four more. Brazilian singer Astrid Gilberto, best known for The Girl from Ipanema, June 5 at 83. Former Prime Minister of Italy and media mogul Silvio Berlusconi, June 12 at 86. The Reverend Pat Robertson, a Baptist minister and broadcaster who helped evangelicals to political power, June 8 at 93. Unabomber Ted Kaczynski, by suicide in federal prison, June 10 at 81. Arrested Scotland's former leader Nicola Sturgeon, June 11, by police investigating alleged financial misconduct tied to the Scottish National Party. She says she is innocent. Announced legislation that would ban Nazi symbols in Australia by Attorney General Mark Dreyfus, June 8. Resigned former UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson from Parliament, June 9, following an investigation into misleading statements he made about government parties during the pandemic. It doesn't say what kind of government parties. Retiring Wheel of Fortune co-host Pat Sajak, after the show's 41st season, which begins in September, he announced June 12. The Brief Health, Five Ways to Combat Self-Criticism, by Angela Haupt. A greatest hit soundtrack produced by self-criticism would sound something like this. You should have done better on that project. Why isn't the house cleaner? You tanked the whole soccer game. You are a bad parent, an even worse colleague, a sorry excuse for a friend, and you are wasting so much time right now that you will be late again. The tendency to engage in negative self-evaluation afflicts almost everyone. People treat their self-criticism as though it is part of themselves, like their eye color, says Rachel Turow, a Seattle-based clinical psychologist and author of The Self-Talk Workout. They say, "Oh, I've just always been my own worst critic," and a lot of people don't realize how damaging it is. Listening to your loud inner critic is a habit, not a fixed personality trait, Turow clarifies. Often exacerbated by childhood trauma, emotional abuse, bullying, sexism, homophobia, social media use, it can also be a form of self-protection. If you're mean to yourself, nobody else can hurt you as bad as you're going to hurt yourself, Turow says. But there is good reason to work on silencing self-criticism, which has been found to worsen depression, anxiety, disordered eating, juvenile delinquency, self-harm, and suicidal behavior and ideation. In some cases, it is a reciprocal relationship. Depression also triggers self-criticism. An effect researchers have found is particularly pronounced for teen girls. People with higher levels of self-compassion, on the other hand, are less likely to experience mental health challenges. Fortunately, plenty of tools can help us talk more kindly to ourselves. We asked experts to share their favorite ways to overcome critical self-talk. 1. Investigate the origins. The first step of thwarting self-criticism is understanding where the thoughts originated, says Tiffany Green, a psychotherapist in Chicago. When her clients say negative things about themselves, she often asks them, "Where did this come from? Who was the first person you heard say this about you?" The response tends to be revealing. Maybe their mom called them lazy, or their grandmother told them they needed to lose weight. It starts to feel like a light bulb, Green says. It allows them to say, "Maybe this doesn't need to continue." The experience is a helpful way to separate yourself from critical thoughts, she adds, rather than accepting them as your own. 2. Set up a self-criticism jar. Every time you catch yourself engaging in a critical thought, throw a coin or a piece of paper into a jar. Green recommends displaying it somewhere it's ultra visible. The goal in the beginning is to fill the jar with lots of coins, because that is a sign you've increased your awareness of your thought patterns and the impact they have on your emotions and behaviors. Over the next 3 to 6 months, however, you should notice you're adding to it less frequently. Having a visual way to monitor your progress can be motivating and rewarding, she says. 3. Celebrate your wins. One of Turo's go-to self-talk strategies is called spot the success. It's sort of the opposite of a to-do list, she says. It's like a done list. Every night before you go to bed, write down 10 things you did that day that benefited you, somebody else, or the world at large. No item is too small. You texted your friend. You got out of bed. You took your vitamin, she notes. It generates this sense in your brain like, I am doing these good things. That can be a powerful antidote to self-criticism and the all-too-familiar feeling that you did not get enough done that day. 4. Replace your inner critic with a neutral voice. Correcting negative thoughts is not easy, and it does not happen overnight. Green suggests first countering them with neutral thoughts. You can work your way up to the positive ones later. Imagine, for example, you routinely criticize your hair. Instead of telling yourself it is lush and gorgeous, try this. What if I'm wrong? What if my hair is fine? That delivers you to a place where you can question the negative thought. And it is more realistic and genuine than forcing yourself to embrace a positive attitude. 5. Look for the gentle lessons. Self-criticism can sometimes contain important information and even prove helpful, Turo says. You might, for instance, be hard on yourself for not keeping in good touch with your friends. That is valuable information, she says. I think it is ultimately coming from this place inside that does want to nourish your friendships. Or if you're upset with yourself for not making it to the gym, that could signal a desire for a healthier lifestyle. Turo advises noticing the criticism gently and then learning from it. Shift how you talk to yourself. Reframe the message. Instead of, "You suck at keeping in touch," try, "This is really important to me. I wonder how I can make it happen more often." The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer Iran remains the Middle East's dangerous tinderbox. Under pressure from Western sanctions, Iran is actively in search of new international trade and investment partners. And it has made some progress, in particular, a Chinese brokered deal to normalize relations with regional rival Saudi Arabia has created commercial opportunities, and its willingness to provide Russia with drones and ammunition for use in Ukraine has created new openings, too. It also helps Iran's government that the nationwide surge of protests that followed the death in police custody last September of a young woman arrested for wearing her headscarf too loosely has largely died down, thanks mainly to the willingness of authorities to arrest large numbers of people and to execute a handful of them publicly. But Iran's leaders know their reprieve from pressure will prove temporary. Economic strain continues. Thanks mainly to sanctions, Iran's currency has lost more than 90% of its value against the dollar over the past decade, and price inflation remains above 40%. Benefits from better relations with the Saudis will take time to materialize, and the rapprochement will likely remain tentative. President Ebrahim Raisi's turn to the East strategy is intended to bring major new infrastructure investment from both Russia and, more importantly, China. But Russia's own economic outlook remains perilous. A wartime partnership with the Kremlin will bring new sanctions on Iran. And the Chinese can buy large volumes of heavily discounted oil from Russia, leaving Iran out in the cold. Continuing hardship ensues that intense public anger and spontaneous protests can re-erupt at any time. In particular, though last year's protesters have moved off the streets, many Iranian women and girls still refuse to wear mandatory headscarves. And the government has worked to reestablish its credibility with religious conservatives by pushing hard on enforcement. Police have issued tickets to uncovered women using public transport or even riding in private automobiles, and businesses are sometimes fined for serving them. With so much built-up resentment and economic pain, another arrest gone wrong could release another wave of unrest, even harder to contain. None of this is new for Iran. A feeble economy and cycles of protest and repression are all too familiar. Yet lurking in the background are both hope and dread that fundamental change may not be far away. In the Islamic Republic's 44-year history, there's been just one transfer of supreme power. In 1989, the death of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini triggered a transition to the current leader, Ali Khamenei, who's remained in power ever since. The octogenarian Khamenei is a cancer survivor rumored to be in declining health, and there's no clear heir apparent for the clerical establishment and political elite to elevate. Today, everyone in Iran with access to wealth, power, and privilege must wonder how succession might alter his fortunes, and a political transition will raise public expectations for change among those exhausted by hardship and social repression. Finally, there are the continuing risks created by Iran's nuclear program and the inability of Iranian and Western leaders to broker a new deal over its future. Here, too, tensions are not new, but ever higher levels of uranium enrichment bring closer the day when Israeli and American policymakers must decide how to block Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon that could trigger a dangerous arms race in the Middle East. It might appear the problems Iran creates for itself and those it poses for outsiders never change. Yet the risk is rising that Iran will soon become one of the world's most dangerous wild cards. Health Matters by Jeffrey Kluger, editor at large. In 2023, it's hard to get away from breaking news about PFAS. a class of more than 12,000 chemicals used in countless products, from nonstick pans to cosmetics to food packaging. These so-called forever chemicals have been linked to a host of physical ills, including increased risk of certain cancers, high cholesterol, hormonal disruption, immune system problems, decreased fertility and developmental delays in children. PFAs, first developed in the 1940s, were not always so well known by people outside the industries manufacturing them, but a new study analyzing industry documents published in Annals of Global Health reveals just how much and how early the two biggest manufacturers of the chemicals, 3M and DuPont, knew about the potential harms the products posed. As the researchers found, 3M and DuPont had preliminary evidence of PFA's toxicity as early as the 1960s and knew broadly about the dangers and chemicals posed by the chemicals by 1970, 2 decades before the public really became aware of the chemicals' health risks. The study also reveals the tactics the companies used to cover up what they knew about the toxicity of PFAs, suppressing unfavorable research, distorting public disclosure of research that did leak out, withholding information from employees who might have been exposed to dangerous levels of PFAs, or reminiscent of those used by the tobacco and fossil fuel industries. Having access to these documents allows us to see what the manufacturers knew and when, but also how polluting industries keep critical public health information private, says Dr. Nadia Gaber, an emergency medicine resident and first author of the paper, in a statement. This research is important to inform policy and move us towards a precautionary rather than a reactionary principle of chemical regulation. In an email to Time, DuPont said in part in 2019, DuPont de Nemours was established as a new multi-industrial specialty products company. DuPont de Nemours has never manufactured PFOA or PFOS, two types of PFAS. DuPont de Nemours cannot comment on allegations contained in the UCSF paper that relate to historical matters. 3M emailed a comment as well, stating, "The paper is largely comprised of previously published documents, as evidenced by the paper's references section, which includes citations dating back as far as 1962. 3M has previously addressed many of the mischaracterizations of these documents in previous reporting. It was in 1961 that the dissembling around the dangers of PFAs started, according to the study. That year, the Canadian Medical Association Journal published a report of workers in PFAs. Now, I'm saying PFAs, and it's always printed PFAS, so there you are. In PFAs factories who fell ill after smoking cigarettes that had been contaminated with PFAs-based Teflon. Shortly after, an account surfaced of a worker on a U.S. Air Force base who somehow came into possession of a similarly contaminated cigarette, smoked it, died on site. DuPont and the Air Force dismissed the account as a rumor, and the author of the original Canadian paper, apparently bowing to industry and military pressure, posted a retraction, saying in part, "All rumors of death are false." But the researchers say DuPont knew better. In 1961, a DuPont study found Teflon exposure led to liver enlargement in rats, with the in-house scientist recommending contact with the skin should be strictly avoided. In 1962, a company scientist conceded internally Teflon may be reactive to excessive heat and handling. In 1970, researchers at a West Virginia DuPont plant found PFA's chemicals could be highly toxic when inhaled and moderately toxic when ingested. None of these findings were made public. Among the human studies the companies conducted, researchers found a possible increase in prostate cancers had been reported among employees at one manufacturing plant. Other findings showed elevated liver enzymes in 61% of 30 workers tested, indicating inflammation and damage to cells in the liver. As the evidence of the dangers mounted, the authors say 3M and DuPont began covering up what they knew. In 1991, researchers unaffiliated with the companies began detecting PFAS in groundwater. The companies responded with a joint press release stating internal studies showed chemicals had no known toxic or ill health effects in humans at concentration levels detected. In 2000, health officials in Lubeck, West Virginia, detected several forms of PFAS in drinking water. In response, DuPont assured the officials all was well. The officials repeated the company line, stating, "DuPont reports it has toxicological and epidemiological data to support confidence that exposure guidelines established by DuPont are protective of human health." But by now, the genie was out of the bottle. Researchers unaffiliated with the companies were publishing more and more studies on the risks of PFAS, linking it to increased risk of certain cancers and other ills. One lawsuit had already been adjudicated. A second case was coming. And in 2000, 3M even announced it would no longer be manufacturing the PFAS-based fabric protecting Scotchgard. Last year, the EPA set permissible levels for PFOA and PFOS in drinking water, and it's working to do the same with six more types by 2026. Public demand is leading to a growing market for PFAS-free products, leaving companies like DuPont and 3M either to abandon or at least curb the chemicals or get left behind. As for the company's reputation, studies like the just-released one might make a difficult cleanup job there, too. The D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. Speaker Kevin McCarthy finally realized he was pinned down. A handful of his fellow Republicans effectively took the House floor hostage June 6 and were not equipped to have a real negotiation. Rather than continue an active standoff for even another day, the House chief decided to pack it in, regroup in private, and try to find a durable detente with the far-right faction of his party. "There is a little chaos going on," McCarthy conceded June 7, employing a massive understatement. He then sent everyone home. The stalled measures on the table would have blocked the feds from banning gas stoves, not a real threat, to be clear, and given Congress veto power over any regulations with consumer costs topping $100 million. Democratic opposition in the Senate and White House all but doomed them, but the stunt was sufficient to embarrass McCarthy and embolden other conservatives, uneasy with a deal the Speaker recently struck with President Joe Biden over the debt ceiling. The substance of the dispute did not matter. It was about the theater. For the moment, McCarthy dodged a noose of his own knitting, one of the conditions he accepted back in January to secure enough votes to become Speaker was an agreement that any of his members could, at any time, call a vote of no confidence. That proffer left McCarthy starting as one of the weakest speakers in decades, and his right flank knew it. In a twist, unseen since 2002, 11 Republicans joined with Unified Democrats to tank the rules package for debate on the pro-gas stoves and anti-federal regs measures. The betrayal left the GOP leadership team shocked and on shaky ground with its rank and file. An agitated McCarthy told allies he did not even know what the troublemakers wanted. They had not articulated any hard demands and seemed more interested in blowing off steam than in securing concessions. Still, McCarthy realized he was boxed in, and the failure of those messaging bills were the least of his worries. Although the rebels stopped short of kicking McCarthy to the curb just yet, they put him on high alert. The biggest obstacle to the firebrands remains a serious one, though. No one is waiting in the wings to step up should McCarthy appear mortally wounded. His lieutenants seem to be holding the loyalty line. The lack of an apparent understudy may help McCarthy survive, at least for now. Even so, the speaker remains beholden to a far right flank. Perhaps it does not even matter who actually holds the gavel. The real power in the House rests with a handful of lawmakers who now feel plenty aggrieved over perceived broken promises to cut spending in exchange for the job. Roughing up a speaker to remind him he needs them on even the most routine moves is a much more appealing prize, and it is one they can get almost any time. Here are a few entries in the summer culture, what did they call it? Summer culture preview. TV, movies, and books. Here's a book, The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store by James McBride, out August 8. In National Book Award winner James McBride's new novel, the discovery of a skeleton at the bottom of a well in the dilapidated Chicken Hill section of Pottstown, PA, leads to the unearthing of decades-old secrets. Gran Turismo, a movie, out August 11. This coming-of-age film is based on the PlayStation racing simulation video game series of the same name, and the true story of a gamer who became a professional race car driver after winning an online competition. Let's see, where's there a movie? Here we are, a movie, Red, White, and Royal Blue, August 11. Tony-winning playwright Matthew Lopez adapts Casey McQuiston's 2019 LGBTQ romance novel about a secret relationship between the first son of the United States and the Prince of England. Another book, Tom Lake by Ann Patchett, August 1. In Tom Lake, Emily, Maisie, and Nell return to their family's orchard in northern Michigan to harvest cherries in the spring of 2020. As they work, their mother, Laura, passes the time by telling them the tale of Tom Lake, a theater company where she spent a summer in her youth. Family Lore, another book by Elizabeth Acevedo, August 1. Acclaimed YA author Elizabeth Acevedo turns to adult fiction with Family Lore, in which Flor Marta is able to predict when someone will die. She is about to throw a living wake, but she won't tell anyone, even her sisters, who the wake is for. The novel paints a portrait of multiple generations of Marta women, many of whom have magical gifts as they navigate family history and Dominican identity. Another TV entry here, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem, August 2. The pizza-loving turtles are emerging from the sewers for the first time in years, hoping to win over the hearts of New Yorkers. In the animated film based on the 80s franchise, produced and co-written by Seth Rogen, Donatello, Michelangelo, Leonardo, and Raphael set out on a mission with the help of their friend, April O'Neil, the bear star, Io Edebiri. Another book, Congratulations, The Best is Over by R. Eric Thomas, August 8. R. Eric Thomas's self-deprecating and deeply personal memoir and essays chronicles the author's return home to Baltimore shortly before the COVID-19 pandemic after more than 15 years away. TV, Only Murders in the Building, Season 3, August 8. Meryl Streep and Paul Rudd join the cast of the true crime podcasting comedy led by Steve Martin, Martin Short, Selena Gomez, which promises a new murder that will need solving by the show's amateur sleuths. Surely these new cast members will send this investigation into a whole new direction. On Hulu. A movie, Problemista, August 4. In Julio Torres's fun, surreal directorial debut, an aspiring toy designer from El Salvador, Torres, on an expiring work visa, tries to bring his ideas to life. An opportunity to work as an assistant for an outcast of the art world, Tilda Swinton, proves to be his only option to stay stateside. Wu-Tang Clan's RZA also stars. Heart of Stone, August 11, more movie here. Netflix's spy action thriller follows Gal Gadot's MI6 agent, Rachel Stone, in a Bond-like role, minus the misogyny, as she attempts to protect a valuable and dangerous asset. Painkiller TV, August 10, Peter Berg tracks the origins of America's opioid crisis in a drama starring Uzo Aduba, Taylor Kitsch, Matthew Broderick. The limited series is based on the 2018 book Painkiller, An Empire of Deceit and the Origin of America's Opioid Epidemic, and the New Yorker article, The Family That Built an Empire of Pain. From Netflix. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. The number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.